Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Oh, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley. And Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
Welcome to the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren. Tonight's mystery, the kidnapping and murder of Maria Riddle in Sycamore, Illinois, 1957. And joining us tonight, executive producer of the news magazine program Inside Edition, and now author of Footsteps in the Snow, the coldest case in U.S. history. We'll be back right after these words.
Hi, I'm Ryan Seacrest for RAD. Over 300 people in this country are killed every week by a drunk driver. That's the equivalent of 2 747 plane crashes every single week. And the problem isn't going away unless we all do our part to stop it. So if you see someone who's about to drive after drinking, get the keys. Don't leave it up to anyone else. Friends don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to The Dog Show. Up next, we have Satchmo. Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right, a group known especially for their couch-snuggling, ball-chasing, face-licking, tail-wagging, backyard-hanging, and, of course, companionship.
And what breed would you say Satchmo is?
I'd have to go with maybe a lavish terrier-hound-chihuahua-looking kind of mix.
Tremendous dog.
I'd also like to point out Satchmo's coloring, a white, gray, brown, black brindle. Simply marvelous.
You know, it's such a treat to watch a dog like this.
Now, let's see him in action.
Look how he makes eye contact with his person.
That's actually known as the treat stare.
How intuitive. And now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles.
Ah, the happy dance, so common with this group.
And finally, the loving face lick.
It's great how he just gets in there and, well, licks.
Fantastic. But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmo is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt.
Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
December 3rd, 1957. It had just started snowing. Marie and I wanted to go outside.
Sycamore in 1957 was a town of about 7,000 people.
Marie and I were playing on the corner of Center Cross and Archie Place. We would go around the pole until a car would come up the street, and then you had to get behind that tree before the car lights hit you.
The town was your ideal small town that you see in the 1950s Christmas movies.
There was a person that came up to both of us. He stopped to talk to us, told us his name. His name was Johnny. Maria took the piggyback ride, and he went maybe 20 feet away with her, and then came back and asked if we liked dolls, and Maria went home to get a doll. She went home and brought her doll back, I said I was going to go home and get my mittens. I was cold. And I left both of them standing there in the corner. And when I got back, they were gone. I was 8 years old. After Maria disappeared, my parents had always said, "You are the only one that can recognize this man. You have to remember what he looks like till we find him." I did have to go to the police station and view lineups of different individuals. I had to go through mugshot books. Everybody looked for Maria. She just disappeared off the face of the earth.
She's sweet, and she'll do what you tell her to do. If you are real kind to her, you know you made a mistake. I know you made a mistake. And God forgives everyone that made a mistake if you will only bring her home. Maria, if you see this, please don't cry. Mommy loves you. Reverend Going was here all night praying for you. And we'll all be so happy to see you. But don't cry and make a fuss. I will see you soon.
She was found 5 months later.
A lot of towns have their boogeymen of legend, but we had a real boogeyman who had snatched a child and killed her.
And we've lived all this time not knowing who had taken her until now.
A Seattle man identified as an ex-cop was arrested for killing a 7-year-old girl 54 years ago in 1957. His arraignment is scheduled for today. Jack Daniel McCullough was in Illinois yesterday as the remains of 7-year-old Maria Ridolph were unearthed by investigators at Sycamore's Elmwood Cemetery.
Call you up in the middle of the night, like a firefly without a light. You were there like a blowtorch burning. I was a key that could use a little turning. So tired that I couldn't even sleep. So many secrets I couldn't keep. I promised myself I wouldn't weep. But one more promise I couldn't keep. It seems no one can help me now. I'm in too deep. There's no way out. This time I have really let myself.
I want to welcome
Charles Lockman. I want to thank you for joining us.
And how are you today?
Great. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Let's start out with telling the listeners who you are before we get into the book.
Well, my name is Charles Lockman, as you said, and I'm a TV producer in New York, and I also write nonfiction books. And my latest effort is Footsteps in the Snow, which is the story of the coldest case in U.S. history ever to be brought to justice. And it was really a three-year effort on my part to research this historically important case, and the writing of it and the final publication of it has really given me a lot of pleasure and I'm very proud of the book.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Let's start with why did you get into writing this book? Like, what led you into the Footsteps in the Snow?
Well, to me, it was a nonfiction thriller that was as gripping as any fictional police procedural, but it had the added measure of being true. I was interested in it as a multi-generational saga. I had written some previous history books about the family of Abraham Lincoln and also a Grover Cleveland history, and I liked the sort of saga of those two histories, and in looking at the true crime genre, I felt that this was a really a unique once in a lifetime story that had elements of history, true crime, and also exposed these unspeakable secrets in one particular American family and the cruelty lurking behind the traditional values of a small town in Middle America.
It's quite different than your previous books. Where did you start when you, this is like you said, 3 years of research. How do you start with a case that's from 1957, that's so long ago?
Well, I first heard about the case in a small kind of item in the New York Times. I was at home with my wife reading through the Sunday Times, and there's this just little kind of couple of paragraphs story about how this guy had been arrested. He was in his 70s, and he had allegedly committed this crime, the murder, the kidnapping and murder of a seven-year-old girl more than a half century earlier. And that instantly fascinated me. I mean, it was an irresistible headline for me to investigate the coldest case in U.S. history and how you could possibly bring the evidence together, make an arrest, and go to trial. So it was a unique case for the police and the prosecutors, and is also a unique story for me to research. I went to Sycamore, Illinois, which is where this takes place, and I was struck by the defendant's physical appearance. I mean, he was this kind of elderly gent with silver hair and on the surface sort of the perfect granddad, and to see how he could be responsible for this, what was the worst crime in this small town's history, was really quite remarkable, and led to this investigation on my part and the book.
Let's tell the listeners about the crime. So what exactly happened back then?
It started the night of December 3rd, 1957, in Sycamore, Illinois, which is about an hour and a half outside Chicago. A lot of people who grew up there call it Mayberry. It reminded them of that, a great little small town, a great place to raise a family. And on this particular night, it was the first snowfall of the winter season, and the little girl, her name was Maria Ridolph, asked her mother if she could go out and play with her best friend, Kathy. So Maria went out. It was about 6 p.m. at night. It was a school night, Tuesday night, and she and Kathy were playing in the snow, and they were enjoying themselves when suddenly out of the snowfall came this young man. He wore a multicolored sweater. He was tallish. He had kind of blondish hair. He wore a hat, and he said his name was Johnny, and he engaged the two girls in the conversation. Now, this was 1957, again, small town America. Even though the kids had been warned to stay away from strangers, it was a more innocent time. In today's age, as we know, if a stranger came up to two little girls playing on the street and introduced himself and started interacting with them, all our antennas would be quivering and wondering what's wrong with this dude. But back then, more innocent time, and the young man, Johnny, gave Maria a piggyback ride, and she was delighted. Then he asked her to go find a doll for them to kind of play with, and she ran back home, came back immediately with her favorite little rubber doll. And meanwhile, her best friend Kathy went to her house to retrieve her mittens, because it was a very cold night and she was freezing. And when she came back, Johnny was gone, and more importantly, little Maria was gone. So the last Kathy saw Maria was getting on Johnny's back and going for this piggyback ride, and presumably Johnny took off with her to whereabouts unknown. And that kidnapping unleashed an immediate search by the townspeople. They went throughout the neighborhood, throughout the city or the town, searching for Maria. But the the trail quickly grew cold, and all that was really left was this trail of an adult's footsteps in the snow, hence the title of my book.
This was a small town, and so this fellow named Johnny came up and talked to the kids. And so did they know who this Johnny was? You know, being a small town, and you tend to know your neighbors and people around you, especially back then. Like you said, the times were more innocent.
Right. That's absolutely true. You do tend to know your neighbors. In this particular case, Kathy, the lone witness, she was 8 years old. She could not identify Johnny. She gave a very detailed physical description of what he looked like. About 18, blondish hair, as I say, tallish. He had very crooked, weird teeth, as she described it, and again the clothing that he wore. But she told the police that she had never seen him before, which immediately made police conclude that he must have been from out of town. It later was determined that Johnny lived only a block and a half away from where Kathy, the witness, and Maria lived. But he was a young man in his late teens. He was 18 at the time of the kidnapping, and Kathy was 8, Maria was 7. So a 7-year-old really doesn't interact with an 18-year-old, which could explain why she didn't recognize him immediately as being somebody who lived in the neighborhood.
And so did they eventually go around and knock on his door? Did anybody approach his family at the time they were searching?
They did. The police received the tip that they should check out this kind of weird guy who lived in the neighborhood, and very quickly the police were knocking on the door of the Tessier family. They, as I say, lived about a block and a half from where the kidnapping took place. His name was Johnny, so that name matched. The physical description matched. He had crooked teeth. He was known to wear this sort of favorite multicolored sweater, which his mother had knitted for him. And he immediately became the number one suspect. So the FBI took him to their command post, which was a motel on the outskirts of Sycamore, and they proceeded to strap him in and give him a lie detector test. They even brought in their best polygraph examiner from the headquarters in Washington. Lo and behold, he passes. The lie detector indicated that he was not responsible for this crime, and he absolutely denied it. And then they questioned his parents, Eileen and Ralph Tessier, and they vouched for him. They gave him an alibi. They said that he was 40 miles away in the city of Rockford, Illinois, at the time that Maria was kidnapped. And then, to kind of put it all in a nutshell, the police obtained the local phone company, information, the evidence that Johnny had made a collect call to his parents' house the night of the kidnapping, and determined that he couldn't have been in two places at the same time. He was 40 miles away. So all those three very critical points, the fact that he was cleared by the polygraph machine, the fact that he had what seemed to be an ironclad alibi, and fact that he made this collect phone call, presumably at the time of the kidnapping, all meant that he was cleared by the FBI in 1957. And then he went into the armed forces. He entered the Air Force, and he left Sycamore fundamentally never to return.
Right. And so the polygraphs back then, were they fairly new, and how good were they? Like, I mean, he passed it.
That's a good question. The polygraph machine had been around for a couple of decades prior to 1957. The FBI had a lot of faith in the polygraph machine. It was only years later when psychologists, shrinks, and other criminologists, law enforcement personnel began really examining the efficacy of the polygraph machine, was it determined that a psychopath who believes in his own set of lies could conceivably pass a polygraph test. Right now, as you, I'm sure you know, polygraphs are not admissible in the court of law. It's considered to be a investigative tool only, and not the real black and white evidence that's admissible in court. But law enforcement likes using it because you go up to a suspect and you ask them to take a lie detector test, and whether he says yes or he says no, it's all useful in terms of the police investigation. But it really is a quasi-science. It's not anything that's definitive, but as a law enforcement tool, part of the package of tools that the that police use to nail a suspect, it's quite useful.
Right. And so now, so he's kind of cleared, kind of gone away. Was there other people that stuck out? Like you said, you know, he was kind of known as being a little bit of a, you know, a little off. Were there other ones out there, or were there other people that came forward and said, hey, I did it, or I know who did it?
There were dozens and dozens of people who came under investigation. Every hotel in Sycamore was looked at in terms of the guests. Because of the description of the suspect Johnny's teeth as being crooked, all dentists in the town were asked whether any of their patients bore his physical description of the kidnapper. They went to all the flop houses and local hangouts. Back then, it was gas stations and the bus depot, and they also investigated every mental patient who had been recently released from an Illinois mental asylum. They investigated prior prisoners who had a history of pedophilia, and anyone who was arrested for crimes against little kids at that time were really investigated and probed. So there are a lot of suspects who went in and out in terms of the attention of the local police and the state police. But it was all pretty much a vapor, a cloud. It was like trying to grab onto a ghost. Nothing really delivered. Right. So for the next 5 decades, it remained Sycamore's greatest unsolved mystery.
And so were there other cases the same, or was this kind of a spotlight? Did it really stick out? Did it make the news and nationally known, or was it just kind of local?
It was a big national story for a time. In fact, President Eisenhower was interested in the case, and he asked FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to personally keep him informed about any progress in the investigation. It got so that Hoover himself was coordinating and directing the investigation from headquarters in Washington. And if you look at the internal FBI documents and memos, you realize very quickly that Hoover's involvement did not help. It really kind of created a giant bureaucracy. The FBI couldn't even make a move. The local agents couldn't make a move without Hoover signing off on it. And it was part of the kind of overall dysfunction of the investigation. No one in law enforcement ever showed Kathy, the lone 8-year-old witness, to the kidnapping. They never showed a photo of Johnny Tessier to her. She was only shown a photo of him in I think the year was 2011, just prior to his arrest. And imagine, just consider that Kathy had been shown hundreds, even thousands of mugshots. She was just this little kid. She couldn't believe there were all these bad people in the world. She was taken out of school, driven to police lineups to see if she could recognize any of the suspects that were being picked up and questioned by the police. And she never really was able to positively identify anyone. So the local case was first being driven by the FBI agents. By the end of Christmas time, the FBI pulled out. It was turned over to the local authorities, but this was a small town. They didn't really have the experience or the know-how to probe a story of a case of this importance, and the case, the investigation just withered. At some point, after Maria Ridolph's body was found in 1958, the state police took over. But by then, the trail had grown cold.
We're talking about Footsteps in Snow with author Charles Lockman. We'll be back right after these words.
This is the sound of salmonella gyrating on your undercooked chicken. And it looks like Mom might be taking it out a little early. Don't let salmonella get funky with your chicken. On average, 1 in 6 Americans will get a foodborne illness this year. So use a thermometer to cook each type of meat to the right temperature. Keep your family safe at foodsafety.gov. Brought to you by the USDA, HHS, and the Ad Council.
I make learning a privilege, not a chore, and frustration a tool, not an obstacle. I'm a teacher. I make more.
Make more. Teach. Visit teach.org. Brought to you by Teach and the Ad Council.
December 3rd, 1957 was the day that Maria was kidnapped. I was 11 years old. My sister Maria was very friendly, trusting, and outgoing. Johnny Tessier, now known as Jack McCullough.
Just 5 doors down is where Jack lived.
Jack was known as being very strange. Once the police were alerted, it is surprising how quickly the entire town was mobilized.
If you can imagine armed citizens walking the streets with shotguns and rifles and handguns tucked in their waistband, knocking on your door.
Everybody looked for Maria. She just disappeared off the face of the earth.
When my mother was dying of cancer in 1994, she was hospitalized. She called my name. She grabbed my wrist and she said, "The one little girl that disappeared, John did it, and you have to tell someone." It was shortly before my mother died that I called the Sycamore police. I did what I thought was right. I fulfilled a promise to my mother, and Maria is finally at peace. It's not been easy. It's been hell at times. It's taken a toll on everybody. When my mother made this confession, did I think my brother was capable of this? Absolutely, I thought Jack was capable of this. Absolutely. Jack had been accused of molesting other girls, too. I believe Jack is an evil man. I saw the evil in Jack's face. I've seen it since in his interviews.
Where is the proof beyond a reasonable doubt? There's nobody to testify on my behalf. They're all dead. That's the problem with getting old.
Jack McCullough is a sad, pathetic man. He's a waste of flesh and deserves to sit in prison for the rest of his life.
I feel my stepfather, Jack McCullough, was wrongfully convicted of murder. This is so upsetting because I love Jack. My original reaction to Jack being arrested was complete disbelief. I was blindsided by it. I've never been afraid of Jack. I've never witnessed any erratic or inappropriate behavior with Jack. In the 20-plus years that I've known Jack, I've always thought of him as a good, trustworthy man. I look at Jack and I see an innocent man. There's a lot of anger for me with this. When Jack was arrested, the only evidence they had was Janet Tessier's statement of her mother's deathbed confession and Kathy Chapman's photo ID, and that was it. Janet Tessier has been the instigator and driving force behind this trial. She was a practicing alcoholic and drug addict, I think it's disturbing when somebody will use government agencies as a personal tool of vengeance. And there does seem to be a pattern with Janet with that. The judge that presided over the murder case had never presided over a murder case before. Three jailhouse informants testified at the trial that Jack had talked to them about killing Maria. All three inmates had something to gain. One of the first men to come forward has already recanted his story in a letter he wrote to Jack. I was completely shocked when he was found guilty. I have always felt that this was just Jack was the last man standing, and the prosecution, they reworked the timeline 57 years later so it would fit Jack. They needed to close the case. This is scary, that this evidence, you can lose your life over.
Did you abuse your sister as she was growing up? Did, didn't you?
My sister and I were very close.
What do you mean that you were very close with your sister?
We're done with this.
Why are you unwilling to talk about these accusations of rape? It
has nothing to do with murder.
But it has something to do with your character. It says a lot about you.
I may have been a sinner, but I'm not a murderer.
Is it possible then that you were acquitted of what you did do and convicted of what you didn't?
That could be.
Was it before they found the body, actually?
4 months. The body was found in April by a husband and wife who were on vacation in northern Illinois. They were mushroom hunting, and they were in the forest. They came upon a log, and they thought at first it was a small animal. And then they took a close look and realized it was the body of a little girl. And this was about 100 miles away from where Maria had been kidnapped. Of course, we don't know. The autopsy was not able to determine her cause of death. Animals had gotten to the body, and it added to the failure on the part of the local law enforcement authorities in trying to figure out who did it. They were not able to identify a cause of death.
So we don't really have a specific reason on why he took the girl and ended up killing her. How long did they think she was alive before she had died? Like, it was 4 months
before? Right. They don't really know. The presumption is that she was killed either the night of or the next day. But that's just speculation.
Right. Now, was this the only girl that went missing at that time?
There is no evidence to indicate that Johnny, the kidnapper killer, was responsible for any other case in Illinois at that time. It was a year, almost exactly a year before Maria was kidnapped. The Grime sisters, who lived in Chicago, were reported the missing, and it was a huge story back then in 1956. The bodies were eventually found, and to this day, that case remains unsolved. But there's no evidence to link Maria Ridoff to the Grime sisters.
Right. And so you kind of are, I think, maybe I'm wrong, but you're sort of making it sound like the investigation wasn't really the best run investigation.
It was completely dysfunctional.
Really? Now, with all the pressure of people, why was it so dysfunctional? Just because too many people involved, like FBI?
Everyone was involved and no one. When the FBI bailed out, it really, as I say, it left the investigation into the hands of the local police. And then when Maria's body was found in the state of Illinois, it meant that the FBI fundamentally didn't have any real jurisdiction over it because the body had not been transported across state lines. They offered themselves up as experts, and any help that they could provide the state police and the local authorities was offered, but at that point it was really in the hands of the state police.
Right. And they also, now in the 70s, I understand that they actually said they had caught the murderer, didn't they, but it wasn't real.
Right. In the 70s, local detective in Sycamore became interested in the case. It's a very interesting story. He was at his desk one day, and a lady came in and said, I know who killed Maria Ridoff. And he didn't even know who Maria Ridoff was. He had not been born in Sycamore and was not totally tuned into local history. And this woman was kind of a local character, and she had no useful information at all regarding Maria's death. But it intrigued the detective, and he spent a lot of hours looking into the case to solve Sycamore's great mystery. And in the 1970s, he reached the conclusion that a truck driver by the name of William Henry Redmond had been responsible for killing Maria. Redmond was a truck driver from Nebraska who was in jail in Pennsylvania for strangling a little girl at a carnival. And he was a notorious character. And, police tried to kind of pin a lot of unsolved child murder cases on him because he, as a truck driver, crisscrossed the country. And consequently, they tried to, he became a suspect in a number of other cases, and this Sycamore detective became pretty much convinced that Redmond was responsible. And in fact, there was a flurry of articles in Sycamore locally that the Maria Ridoff case had been solved about 25 years after her murder. And of course, we now know that that's not true.
Right. How did the family and everybody take to that?
The family was, the Riddles were called in for a briefing, a private briefing by the detective. It was the parents were still alive, and Maria's brother Chuck and her two sisters, the Pat and Kay. And the father, Mike Ridoff, was this, by then, a very elderly man. And he was not interested in the information, really. He just felt, you know, what's the point? Maria is gone, and this guy Redmond is dead, so it didn't make a lot of sense to him. The siblings were more interested, but they were very dubious about this detective's conclusion, because one, the ages didn't match. According to Kathy, the lone witness, Johnny was in his late teens, but Redmond would have been about 34 at the time of Maria's kidnapping. And the physical description also didn't match the hair color, the height. The only thing that made sense was the fact that Redmond was a truck driver who was believed to have been working in Illinois at the time of Maria's abduction.
Huh.
So the family was dubious.
The best friend, Kathy, the witness, how did all this kind of affect her? Like, was there guilt? How was she doing with all this?
Well, that's a good question. From the night of Maria's kidnapping through all those years that passed, Kathy made it her mission to search for Johnny. And she was in a terrible position. A lot of parents didn't want Kathy playing with their children anymore after the kidnapping. Why? Because there's always a concern that Johnny, the killer kidnapper, would come back one day to Sycamore and take the lone witness, Kathy. So people were afraid, little kids were afraid to hang out with Kathy, and she became so uncomfortable, her parents moved out of the neighborhood. And all through the years that passed, Kathy, who's this wonderful, wonderful woman, made it her mission to find Johnny. What would she do? She would, whenever she was on vacation, whenever she was walking down the street, she would look into the faces of strangers, and the image of Johnny, the kidnapper, was imprinted on her mind. And she knew that if she ever ran into this guy, she would be able to identify him. Then, of course, the 1970s come, and this detective makes the big announcement that he believes he had solved the mystery, that this truck driver from Nebraska was responsible. And after that point, Kathy told me that she basically stopped looking. She thought the case was solved. It was only again in 2011, when the state police reopened the case and showed her the an array of photos that included Johnny Tessier, it was the first time she'd ever seen the photo. She couldn't believe that this had never been shown to her when the case was alive and kicking back in 1957. She couldn't believe that she had never been shown that photo. Had it been shown to her, she said that she would have immediately identified him as the kidnapper. I'll tell you another story about how this case affected Kathy. When she was dating the young man who would later become her husband, they met at a bowling alley. His name was Mike, great guy, and Mike told his mom that he was dating this girl, he was in love with her, blah, 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 and the mom said, "What's her name?" And Mike said, "It's Kathy Sigmund." And the mom said, "Do you know who she is? She's the little girl who's with Maria Ridoff." And no one wanted to be around Kathy. So life for her in the early years in particular was very difficult.
Yeah, no, it must have been. Plus all the feelings, too, of guilt as you get older, too, right?
Totally. Could it have been Kathy who was kidnapped instead of Maria? Absolutely. It was really fate that picked Maria over Kathy. Why was Kathy spared and Maria taken? Well, it could very well have been the fact that her little hands were cold and she ran home to get her mittens, leaving Johnny the opportunity to take Maria.
Yeah, that's something that's... How could you ever forget? How did they actually end up finding him or getting this kind of solved?
Well, it's really a fascinating story. a woman named Eileen Tessier, Johnny's mom, was dying of cancer, and she was in a hospital room outside Chicago, and her daughter, Janet, was in the room, and Eileen, the mom, was kind of slipping in and out of consciousness, and suddenly she kind of awoke and said, Jan, come here, and her daughter Jan went to her and held her little bony hand and said, what is it, Mom? And Eileen, the mom, said, Johnny, those two little girls, Johnny did it. And Jan couldn't believe what she was hearing. She instantly knew that her mom must be referring to the Maria Ridoff case. So what did Jan do? Well, she did what a good citizen should do, even though it was her own brother who was the suspect. She notified the local police, Sycamore Police, and a detective did come to interview her. But when the detective found out that the information was coming from a near comatose dying cancer patient, he basically said, there's nothing we can do with this information, and that was the end of that investigation. Years later, Jan called the FBI in Chicago and tried to get them interested in the case. And they said, well, you really should notify the local police. And Jan said, well, I did. And the FBI said, well, that's the best advice we can give. Then more years passed, and finally in 2008, Jan decides to send an email to the state police in Illinois. And she, in a brief way, outlined the circumstances of the case and the new information, meaning her mom's deathbed confession. And she hit send, not really expecting anyone to answer. Lo and behold, the next day she gets a call from a captain from the state police in Illinois who says, come up and talk to us. And she did. She drove up a couple of days later to the state police in Illinois and sat down with these bulldog investigators who were instantly fascinated by the historical importance of the case. And what happened then was the launching of an investigation that was finally wrapped up in 2011 with the arrest of Johnny Tessier. By then, he had changed his name. He was now known as Jack McCulloch, and he was living in Seattle.
When they caught him, did you get a chance to go in and actually interview him yourself?
Oh, yeah. I interviewed him in jail in Illinois, and we exchanged a lot of letters. And we also interviewed him for a documentary called Footsteps in the Snow that was based on the book. So I've had hours and hours of conversation with Jack McCulloch, or a.k.a. Johnny Tessier, and to this day, he absolutely insists that he is innocent. I think on his deathbed, when that comes, he will insist on his innocence, and maybe he even believes he is innocent, but maybe that's part of his pathology. He insists that the timeline proves that he couldn't have been in two places at once and that he's innocent. But I think that alibi has been, you know, successfully shot down at his with the results of the police investigation.
Right. And so how do you feel about it? Like, when you talked to him, did you feel he was kind of like he really believed in what he said, or do you think he was just there's something wrong with him maybe, or...
Well, I think knowing his history and having researched his life and knowing all the bizarre episodes in his life that he was involved in, I believe that justice was served. I think that the trial, the investigation, and the resulting conviction were all absolutely on target, and I think that Maria's killer is in the place where he should be, meaning a state penitentiary for the rest of his life.
Yeah. So do you think that he had done any other crime similar to it over all those years that he's been out and alive?
Well, I want to be careful about answering that.
Right.
The bottom line is that there's no evidence to indicate that he targeted a... any other little girl. I know that after his arrest, the local authorities in Washington State probed and consider him a suspect in a number of other missing child killings, but nothing was ever brought before a grand jury, and no arrests certainly were made. But in his life, he ended up becoming a police officer in a small town in Washington State. And in 1983, he pled guilty to communicating with a minor for immoral purposes. What happened was that when he was a cop in the city of Milton, he invited a teenage runaway to live with him. He was then dating some girl, and he ends up with this runaway in his house. And the runaway describes an incident where where he really acted more like a boyfriend than a adult police officer. He would ask her to give him massages, and he would teach her techniques of giving a great massage. And one night she was alone with him when he told her to kind of spread out and on the floor. I'm going to teach you how to give you a massage. And then at a later date, he went up to her while she was sleeping on the couch in the living room, and performed an act that led to his arrest and his eventual guilty plea. So this guy has a lot on his plate in terms of a notorious history. He does not have a unblemished record by any means.
So did you ever feel threatened or any negativity from him or anybody else during the research of the case?
No, I didn't. I think it would be silly of me to feel in any way threatened by him. He's locked up in jail, and I certainly never said anything to me to indicate that I should be worried. After the documentary aired on the LMN network, he did watch it, and he watched it with a group of fellow inmates. This was in November last year, and apparently they get cable in state prison. And he sent me a letter that indicated that once his appeal was adjudicated and he was released from prison and determined to be innocent of this crime, that I'd have to do a lot of rewriting on my book, and I'd have egg on my face. Well, suffice to say that just a few weeks ago, the state appeals court upheld the conviction, so I don't have to do much rewriting at all. In fact, none.
Hmm. How did all the families respond? How did the family to the murdered daughter feel? Are they all relieved or happy, or are they sort of moved on in a way, or got some?
Well, it's very interesting. The Riddle family, there are now two siblings left, Chuck and his sister Pat, and they were in court every day. They have been really amazing in terms of following the case and seeing justice done. And Chuck is a church deacon, and his life was forever impacted by what happened to his little sister. And curiously, they've become very close friends with the Tessier family. This case would not have gone where it is now without Jan Tessier, the killer's sister, informing the state police of what her mother told her on her deathbed. And all her siblings, with the exception of the suspect, Johnny, or Jack as he's now known, are totally on board with her activity. In fact, they also attended the trial, and they expressed their appreciation and respect for the Riddles. They're all friends. They all have high regard for each other. And I, in my experience, I've never seen any anything like it, where the suspect's family are supportive of the victim. And it was really quite remarkable to see. Jack McCulloch, a.k.a. Johnny Tessier, does have his own support. He married his wife, Sue, lives in Seattle. She absolutely believes in his innocence, and so does her daughter, Jamie, who has been at the forefront of the online effort at trying to prove that her stepfather is innocent. Jack McCulloch is capable of getting support. A lot of people in his family absolutely think he's a monster, and other people in his stepfamily, if you will, believe that he's been railroaded.
Now, how do people get a hold of you, or if they want to, are you doing any book tours or any speaking events coming up?
They can buy the book at any good bookstore. It's probably in the true crime section. It's called Footsteps in the Snow. It certainly is available on all online bookstores, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, etc., and PAL Books. It's also available as an ebook, obviously, so either as a paperback or an ebook. I think it's a great read. The critical reception has been terrific. The reviews have been great, but even more important, the people who have read it, there's a vigorous online back and forth regarding the book, and it's been very gratifying to read so many of the comments, people calling it one of the best true crime books they've ever read. So it's been very, very special.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for doing the work and bringing it to everybody's attention. And thank you for coming on and taking the time to talk about it.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a great talking to you.
You can listen to us anytime, anywhere now. Download our free app now for the iPhone and iPad. Look for the Warren Exchange or House of Mystery app at the Apple App Store today.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of the Z-Talk Radio Network.
I'll be back.